Hey, Mark, I was listening to Paramore the other day, and it really made me think about the amygdala and the limbic system.
You just made those words up, didn't you?
What, Paramore?
We're the Nevermind the Music podcast, where one musician
and one psychologist
talk songwriting and the mind, one song at a time.
We'll hear everything from Green Day and Outkast
to Stevie Wonder and Dua Lipa.
And we mostly try to stay on topic.
Except for when we don't want to.
Nevermind the Music, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to a bonus episode of Rings and Rituals. I'm Marilyn, the librarian of Rivendell. My co-host, Sara, shield maiden of Rohan, is in the marches of Ithilien, keeping watch with the prince. So tonight, I have a special guest, John Lorehound, our producer and podcaster extraordinaire from The Lorehounds. Among many other things, John is the musician who arranged our theme song for this podcast. So I invited him to join me in a discussion of music in relation to ritual in the Payne and McKay series Rings of Power. If you enjoy this special episode, you can email us at ringsandrituals@thelorehounds.com and or you can join our Rings and Rituals channel on the Lorehounds Discord. We'll include all that information in the show notes. Also, we are a proud affiliate of the Lorehounds Barovian Broadcast Network, where you will find all sorts of interesting podcasts on TV, films, books, video games, and other stories. Our thanks to all the listeners who support the Lorehounds through good ratings on Apple iTunes, joining the Lorehounds Patreon or Supercast, and other forms of donation. If you like what we're doing here, consider giving them a boost as well. And now, here is our conversation on music and ritual. Enjoy! So tonight we're going to have a special guest join us in a quick review of the musical styles that we're seeing or will be seeing for five of the cultures and a few of the individuals of Middle-earth. This includes both the music that the characters are making or hearing themselves, also known as diegetic sound, as well as the music from Bear McCreary's excellent score. John Lorehound is half of the reason that this wonderful collection of podcasts known as The Lorehounds exists. He and David started off over a year ago covering the lore for Rings of Power and invited me on to talk about what a Barovian is. Other guest appearances followed, and now John is our producer for Rings and Ritual. He's also a musician. John, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and how Lord of the Rings and music both entered your life?
Sure, and thanks, Marilyn, for having me here. You know, you've been on our podcast so many times, and I love what you have to say every time, and I know our listeners are always just clamoring for more Marilyn, so we gave them a whole feed, and now they have you and Sarah, and that's great. Really, really thrilled to be here. I am a podcaster of almost 2 years now. Over on the Lorehounds feed, we do, if you're interested in Tolkien, we do Silmarillion stories, where we break down the Silmarillion basically a chapter at a time. Sometimes we combine. That's why we're all loosey-goosey on the titles. But it's a great time. We'll be covering Rings of Power Season 2 when that comes out, episode to episode. But for now, you know, we just cover Shogun. We just finished True Detective. We got plenty of stuff going on.
Oh, yeah.
As far as music, my first career was in music. I went to school for music production. I did live sound for a number of years before I decided to change career paths. But it's still a big part of my life. I still play as a hobby and I still love listening to it. And often when I'm listening to scores like this, I'm just thinking about the music theory I learned in college and sort of comparing it to different techniques, and it makes my brain work. It makes my brain work. It wakes me up. It's why I don't listen to, if I'm writing something, I can't listen to like classical music because it will turn my brain into an analytical machine for that instead.
That's cool. I also majored in music in college. I played violin for many years until
tendonitis.
Yeah, tendonitis, unfortunately, put an end to that, but I also sing and, I have a dim memory of taking music theory classes and taking a composition class and having my professor tell me that the little string quartet thing that I wrote sounded like Finnish Vikings. And I just decided not to tell him that there were never any Finnish Vikings.
Well, that's fun.
So some of it comes back every now and again, but a lot of it I do have to double check. And I can listen to all kinds of music all the time, except opera. If I know the opera, I can't put it on while I'm working. I just can't do that.
Fair enough.
Too pulled into the whole drama of it all.
It's just a lot of drama in it. And plenty of drama in the Rings of Power, too.
Absolutely. And plenty of music. We, of course, have Barry McCreary's amazing score. So let's get to it. Let's start with the elves, because that's pretty much the first melodic culture, if you will, that we hear. How would you describe them?
Well, I think you've described them really well here. Maybe we should start with your descriptions, because you wrote them.
Okay, fair enough. I think elves are all about harmony.
Mm-hmm.
When they have melodies, they're quite fluid and expressive. Little to no percussion that I can remember, except in maybe, you know, specific dramatic circumstances. There's solo vocals and choral vocals, but primarily when I think elves, I think choral music, usually mm-hmm. higher register and major keys.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Galadriel is obviously the protagonist of this show at this point. You know, we don't know if they're going to start shifting around perspectives more, but I think it's safe to mm-hmm. say after season one, she was the protagonist.
Definitely.
And so her melody there, her leitmotif, you know, we go back to Wagner with his leitmotifs.
Well, hello. He invented them, right?
I know. He did. I had a professor in college who absolutely hated Wagner as a person, but was like, I have to teach you about his music mm-hmm. because he was so important. Well, and it's true.
That's pretty much my whole feeling about him as well. He was a really something of a wart as a human being, but he made some of the most beautiful music I will ever hear. And right. invented a whole kind of dramatic theater, visual, everything. He wrote his own words to go along with the melodies that he was creating. And it was supposed to be a total gesamt experience, mm-hmm. a combined experience together from beginning to end. And changed a lot of the techniques, the musical techniques that people used. He had a chord which was eventually called the Wagner chord, which is, I can't remember if the adding sevenths or what it was, and the Tristan chord. He did it in Tristan and Isolde, and other operatic composers followed with that. But anyway.
Oh, very nice. Well, I mean,
not Wagner, but
I just want to be clear. If you're in the listenership right now, you don't know what a leitmotif is. It's just a theme or melody that comes around when it's attached to a certain character or setting.
Mm-hmm.
And this was something that, well, it seems really commonplace today, right? You know, we have all the different superheroes with their leitmotifs. We have the Shire theme, things like that. This was really a byproduct of Wagner's work.
Yes. Like,
this really was started by him. And so yes. I think it's really cool to see someone like Bear McCreary using that today.
Definitely. And the way they build on each other, the leitmotifs, and they develop as the characters and the conflicts develop
right.
and change.
That's the beauty of it, is where they start interacting, right?
Yes. And a really fun demonstration of that is to listen to the beginning of the Ride of the Valkyr, because you can hear, first you hear the wind, and then you hear the galloping hooves, and then you hear the horses neighing, and et cetera, et cetera. And then you hear the Valkyries with their hayatahos. And then when the Valkyries leave the stage, they do exactly that thing in reverse order.
Mm.
It's that precise.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So Galadriel's leitmotif, you know, to me, it screams longing.
Mm-hmm.
That's really, you know, it feels like she almost resolves the chord, but then she gets there and the melody resolves, but the chords go in an unexpected direction.
Yeah.
And it reminds me a lot of her diving off the boat on her way to Valinor.
Yes, definitely. And the longing, of course, to my mind, is the unresolved grief.
Mm-hmm.
That for her brother and for the light of the two trees, for all of the things that she has lost and has poured that grief into her search for vengeance, which is not an uncommon thing to do.
So I think Galadriel's a really fascinating character, and I don't want to go too deep into it since we're just on music right now.
Yeah, but go deep. What the heck? We're Lorans.
But this whole idea that, you know, she, I think, longs for Valinor, but mm-hmm. if you look at her here and in even in The Lord of the Rings, it seems like she almost feels like she's too damaged to go back there until she rejects the ring with Frodo.
Right, right. Damaged, and I think, well, of course, it's so hard to talk about Galadriel in a definitive way because Tolkien never did himself.
Right.
You know, there's so many different Galadriels depending upon which part of the legendarium you're reading. So I think we all kind of land on the ones that we like best. But there is, I think, a thread throughout most of them, which is she does want to be a powerful person. She does mm-hmm. want to be a leader. And she right. does so in a whole variety of ways. Throughout all of the adventures that we read about her, one of the lines that really struck me, and I hope we see something of this in the Rings of Power series, she looked upon the dwarves with the eyes of a general.
Hmm.
Now that just covers so much territory. And I would really love to see Galadriel walking through Khazad-dûm in all its glory and splendor, making connections with the dwarves, which then in the end repay in the final battles that we see in the Second Age. And right. then when she meets Gimli and she's talking about the beauty of Khazad-dûm, she has seen it. She saw it in its heyday, in its peak. And Gimli never saw that.
Hmm.
And I just find that so poignant. Poignant is something that ties in with Galadriel a lot. I don't think she'd want to be called that by anybody necessarily, but it definitely seems to be there.
Yeah. I mean, I think Morfydd Clark does a really good job of capturing the fierce side of Galadriel, this determination that seems to be with her throughout the Second Age. And sort of beneath the surface, just beneath the surface in the Third Age.
Yeah. And her melody, perhaps, I mean, it can be stated very dramatically, of course, but I still think that the melody reminds one. I mean, she has her famous line, "There is a tempest within me." There is, and there's also this longing, this hirraeth, as the Welsh would say, for what she has lost and what she remembers. And I think also the knowledge that you can't go back. That can't be recovered right. in any way.
Right.
And the ending of her melody in the minor key, of course, seems to kind of put the stamp on that. Say, yep, that's right. This is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, it's almost a heartbreaking melody, the way it lingers on certain notes and how it doesn't quite resolve the way you expect it to.
Definitely heartbreaking.
It's just a long line of disappointments, which is really, mm-hmm. sadly, a lot of Galadriel's life up to this point.
You could also maybe call it the long defeat. I just thought of that just now. I wonder if that was in Bear's mind when he wrote this melody for her.
Yeah. I don't know. Shall we talk about Harfoots?
Oh, definitely.
Nobody yes. gets left behind.
Nobody walks alone.
Look, I'm well known for my critique of the line with our hearts even bigger than our feet.
I think that's one of your signature pieces, John.
I can't tell you how much that bothered me, but
I think we got the message. The
I did love the vibe of the Harfoots generally. I thought they captured what I could see turning into Hobbit culture. Turning into the Shire eventually.
Yes. Yes.
And I thought they did a really brilliant job with that. And I think Bear did an amazing job turning the music into something reflecting that. If you want to mm-hmm. give your paragraph of sort of things that you picked up from them first, and then I'll talk about more of my thoughts.
Sure. In keeping with their culture, simple single line melodies, not a lot of, you know, polyphonic. Necessarily, but definitely polyrhythmic, meaning lots of different rhythms coming in against one another. So you almost feel this kind of jostling as they're trudging along the road. It's not foursquare like the dwarves, and we'll get into them in a minute. I mean, the dwarves are marching, and they're marching, you know, very straight lines, and, you know, you can see that. The Harfoots, not so much, and yet they keep together. And in keeping with their living in and with nature, most of their instruments are very natural instruments. They're made of wood, they're made of clay, natural percussive objects, you know, making their striking a log with a stone or something to make a rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
But that's more of the diegetic, the stuff that they're doing. Bear has thrown in marimbas, which, of course, are wood that are, you know, tubular pieces of wood that are struck. Or maybe they're flat ones. Now I'm blanking. Yeah, the marimba is the flat pieces of wood that, when you strike them, have different tones. And they use Uilleann pipes, which are the Irish bagpipes that work in a slightly different way. Uilleann is Irish for elbow, and at one version of this, they work the bellows with their elbows under their arms, kind of thing. Obviously more complex than something that the Harfoots are going to come up with, but I think he threw that in order to pull in this sort of semi-Irish feel, rightly or wrongly.
Right. Yeah, I know we've had the conversation, right, of is it proper to constantly be giving peoples that you are portraying as simpler an Irish accent?
Right. Well, and he's following with a Howard Shore. I mean, Howard Shore's melodies for the Shire were clearly influenced by Irish melodies and so forth. And instruments, you know, the flute is shared between the two of them, although in the case of the Harfoots, it's wooden flutes. Probably is in the Shire, too. Who knows?
Right, right.
One of the neat things is a shifting time signature. Time signature refers to the pattern of the rhythm. So you might have a 1, 2, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, like the dwarfs, very four square structured. Yep. You might have a 6, which would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, which sometimes people like to be tricky and go 1, 2, 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, which would be what we call 3 against 2.
Yeah, what we've got here, I always say you switch to 3-4. Be honest with yourself.
It all depends on what really kind of notes they're writing. If it's a series of, you know,
triplet eighth. You switch to 3-4. Write the right time signature.
No, I got to do it faster, so it's 6-8. You know, 6/8 notes. But what's really interesting is when they shift from a 5 beat to a 6 beat. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And the 5 beat is often associated with folk melodies. So again, this sense of quote unquote rusticness, because they're using this. But Nori's theme is always, to my recollection, in 6/8, which is that 1, 2, 4, 5, 6, which to me says, okay, the Harfoots are wandering and they have, you know, they have their certain stops that they make. They don't always take the same path to get to them. Nori is different. Nori knows that she wants to be going somewhere in a straight line.
Right.
She might not always know what she's sure of herself. She might not know what her goal is, but she knows there's something out here greater than our wanderings. And so her melody is very much a directed melody, and you can follow it through, at least to our Western ears, right? We have to remember any of the things we say are definitely colored by our Western perspectives of music. I mean, other people who have studied other cultures might have a different experience. Mm-hmm. And in particular, her melody sounds remarkably similar to a melody from Algeria.
Oh, really?
And I'm probably going to butcher this pronunciation. My interpretation is Ad Ket Hent Ti Ulas.
Hmm.
And the theme for that is approximately da 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 dum da 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 dum da da dum ba da 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 dum ba da da dum da 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 dum ba da dum ba da 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 dum. So they do that same thing, that 5/6 kind of thing.
Yeah, sort of rushing to the next upbeat, right?
Yeah.
Or the next downbeat, rather.
If anybody wants to hear a true rendition of that instead of what I just did, this is on an album by a group called Labana.
Maybe we could link it in the show notes.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that particular album there's is called Sojourns, which is another word for wandering.
Right. Oh.
And I would love to know if Bear ever heard them or ever heard that song in some capacity.
Maybe we could get him back on the pod sometime.
Hey, let's do it.
We could get him on Rings and Rituals.
Yeah, I mean, if we play this for him and he can tell us how many ridiculous assumptions we made.
yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm sure there are things that we pick up that are Markley's, but there are also
right Markley music.
There are also things that he meant to put in there, and he'll be thrilled that anybody pointed it out. You pointed out pretty much all of the notable things about Harfoots. I will say the thing that even asked me that made me want to ask you, would you like me to come on and do a music segment? Was listening to one of the Harfoot themes. I think it was Harfoot Life, which is your theme song.
Yes, thank you so much.
Oh, no problem. I'm happy to make it. But I just was so loving how it sounded like they're on their carts, they're on their little portable hobbit holes. And they hit a rock on one of the wheels, and that's skipping to the next downbeat, right? They just get back on their feet. They're just, they just hit a rock. It was so fitting for this nomad culture.
Mm-hmm. Yes. When you tell me about that, I just thought that was totally cool.
Love it. Love it. Shall we talk about the big people?
Oh yes, let's, because this particular people is presented as possibly the grandest of all, even grander than the elves in a way. This is the Numenoreans. You know, when we first see them in all their splendor and glory, the rhythm for them is something called the baladi, which is Egyptian folk rhythm, or what some people would call belly dance music. So it's bum, 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 bum. Bum, bum, ba-dum, bum. So it's fascinating that he gave them this rhythm because it's very strongly associated with Egypt. And there are other Mediterranean influences throughout to create this culture, but I'm pretty confident that this is why he chose this rhythm, this particular people, because it's familiar, even to Western ears. You know, you'll hear it sometimes on sort of generic folk music discs or something like that, or I mean, if you dance baladi, then it's quite familiar.
Right. I mean, there's so many comparisons to Numenor and Atlantis, right? And so
the
question is, where was Atlantis?
Right. And what did it have to do with Egypt?
Right.
But I just think it is a rhythm that conveys otherness. You know, one of the first things Halbrand says is, who are these people, that can build all these structures? And, what is a man like me doing here? And she said, they're not men like you.
Knowing that Halbrand was Sauron the whole time, do you think he actually was impressed by the Numenoreans?
I do. I think it's pretty safely textual to say for a long time he just ignored them.
Okay.
He had other fish to fry, if you like. Yeah.
Other Adars to fry.
We'll see, won't we? I don't know that there's any really clear information about what Sauron is doing in the immediate aftermath of Morgoth's fall. But it seems that his focus is all on the elves when he first returns to Middle-earth. Because I think he doesn't think very much of humans at this point.
Right.
But then later on, I mean, he resented humans to the extent that they were also one of the reasons why the Valar decided that they were going to take out Morgoth once and for all. But when he does eventually discover how incredibly advanced they are, it's kind of interesting, isn't it, to set him next to Pharazôn and see, two men, for lack of a better word, at this point, with very similar notions about wanting to use another culture for their benefit.
All right.
Interesting. You can see how Sauron was pretty comfortable in his understanding of what made Pharazôn tick. So I like that they drew that in. I wonder if Bear will ever write a theme for Farazon, Christian.
I'm sure as Farazon becomes more of a central figure in this story, Bear's going to have to do some kind of scoring for him.
I would hope so. Yeah, I would hope so. So to this really wonderful rhythm that always makes me want to start dancing and doing belladi moves and so forth, you have a single line melody in a pentatonic scale, right, which is a slightly different from our usual
right.
Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do.
And I noticed often in parallel octaves, there was a lot of octaves going on, not just a single melody.
Mm-hmm. And you do occasionally get the single line of counterpoint. So you are starting to get polyphonic, you know, two lines together, which we kind of haven't really seen before. I mean, yes, the elves were stacking melodies on top of each other chorally, but this mm-hmm. is more obviously two distinct melodies that were kind of talking to one another in a way. The instruments are Mediterranean style instruments, loosely described, with more melody and harmony when the chorus joins in. And the chorus is this lovely sigh, you know, and you wonder, what are they sighing for? You know, the bliss of Numenor or the bliss of the Valar or what? It's interesting to speculate on that. And also typical of the Mediterranean and the Belladi, lots of different types of drums, smaller and larger. So you might have a tabor, which is one, you know, the sort of hourglass shaped drums that may just be covered on one side or have drum head on both sides. And they also bring in the horns, the French horns, to express, I think, the grandeur. You know, French horns usually represent
right
heroism and grandeur and splendor and
regality.
Yes, definitely will. And then we have this melody that it's a little bit, I can't remember if it's defined clearly anywhere. It relates to both Elendil and Isildur. And I think by extension to the faithful.
Mm.
And I hear it as a something of a Spanish flavor, which is kind of ironic because, of course, the first thing in mind steeped in English history would go to would be the Spanish Armada.
Right.
And the Numenoreans will eventually build themselves an armada. So this is more in flavor and feel, but there is a guitar ornament at one point. I think it's the first time I've heard guitar in this series. And when they're on the sea, when they're on the ships, Bear throws in the harmonica, which kind of ties. And he does it in a different melody. He does it in a ya da 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 da, almost like a jig sort of a melody. But that's back to the Numenorean theme.
Yeah.
And in that melody, you will occasionally have solo instruments, a trumpet or an oboe, depending upon the circumstances, playing the melody, which again is just full to my ears of longing and regret.
Yeah.
And loss.
You know, I think of the Numenoreans, how they start to fade more quickly as they get farther away from the Valar, as they start to cling to death more. You know, you're mm-hmm. you're clinging to death, and yet in the end there's just this one sad instrument just sort of fading away. Whereas you had this grand chorus before. You could have gone out while it was still a grand chorus.
Yes, definitely.
The dwarves.
Well, before we do dwarves, you have a note here saying that the chorus sounds similar to dwarven music, so tell me more.
Well, I was listening to them side by side just because I was listening to the soundtrack more today, and sometimes the choirs sound very similar on the two. You know, when I'm listening to the Khaz Ad-Dûm theme and the Numenorean theme, you have that really forceful bass and baritone harmony coming through.
Oh, okay.
That really made me go, huh, are they trying to tell me a similarity here?
Maybe just for melodic range. I mean, we're supposed to receive Numenor as being a really big thing.
Yeah.
Even if they are in their days of decline. And of course, the dwarves, to some degree, are in their ascendancy.
Right. And I mean, even Aragorn in the Lord of the Rings is still supposed to be grand compared to normal human. And so,
sure.
So you still, and I know he's supposed to be sort of Isildur restored, right? But
right.
Even so, I think that if he was Isildur restored and he's this grand king, you need to sell me on this whole island was full of people like that.
Right. And that's kind of hard for our minds to grasp, isn't it? We'll see how the show does right. with that. I wonder if he's, he talks about being Isildur's heir, but also Elendil's heir of Numenor.
Right. Right.
And his battle cry is not Isildur, it's Elendil.
Yep. Yep.
So it's kind of interesting to see how those two ancestors go back and forth in his mind.
We need a clip of Liv Tyler saying, you are Isildur's heir, not Isildur himself.
Which is actually said by he himself in the text. So,
Yeah, well they certainly inserted a lot more self-doubt into Aragorn's arc in the movies.
They sure did. Anyway. Moving on to dwarves.
I love the dwarves.
Oh, yeah. I find myself hearing their song in my head when I'm out walking.
Do you walk to the pace of that? Because that's a pretty fast pace. I mean.
Yeah, I do.
Dum, 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 dum.
Particularly downhill.
Okay, fair enough.
Uphill, not so much.
All right.
So, a very heavy four-square rhythm, which is eminently appropriate for these strong, stocky dwarves that humans thought returned to stone when they died, which, of course, doesn't happen. But that tells you something about their character as well, that this is how they're perceived from the outside. Yeah. Lots of hammer strikes, not unsurprisingly, given their work and their joy. So, and drums and brass, string basses, they're the first ones I think we hear doing the rhythm, the bass line there. And the singing also, you know, bass baritones and a very simple melody. There's part A and a part B, and that's pretty much how it happens. There's not a lot of development of melodic development, but the different instruments that play it definitely show development. I mean, I think of one statement of the Dwarven theme when Prince Doran and Elrond are talking, and Doran realizes that, you know, he might not be able to save his friend. And there's this very quiet statement of the theme. And it's, you know, this is a very different side of the dwarves. This isn't the bold, brash, challenging call and response kind of dwarves, but a very tender side, although they probably wouldn't like me saying so.
Well, I think that's right, though, right? I mean, look at Gimli when he gets the hairs from Galadriel. He's very touched. He's very touched. Yeah. And he's got his best friend right beside him, Legolas.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things I love about the text for Gimli and Galadriel is Gimli is actually the best representation of the courtly love that's written about in the Troubadour and Trouvère and their songs about, you know, the pure love for an unattainable woman, and yet will maintain her honor. You will fight anybody who speaks ill of her. You will serve her until you die, and get three hairs from her head is enough to send you in a tiz. And, you know, of all the people I might imagine in a French court around the time of the Troubadour and the Trouvère, Gimli is probably the last on the list.
Right.
It is. Dwarves are very loyal once they give their fealty. And we definitely see that.
And you even see Doran get upset with Aragorn for not paying attention to his feelings enough. You know, he's says you may live for a very long time, but I don't, and you missed half my life, basically.
Yes, that is a very touching.
Yeah.
Because I think once dwarves swear friendship, they take it very, very seriously, as do elves, or at least Elrond.
Right.
But it was the misunderstanding of the cultural concepts of time and the passage of time. Elrond was generally remorseful when he realized the pain that he had caused, because that's certainly not something he would want to do.
Right.
But he's also being a politician, not a politician. He's being a statesman at that point. Mm-hmm. He came with a mission, and he never forgets it.
It's just
his fortune that the mission combines beautifully with his desire to repair the friendship.
Right. You know what else I loved about the dwarves was the stone singing.
Yes.
And I'm sure you're going to talk about that with Sarah when you know, the ritual of it. But the whole idea of it, it reminded me so much of Loial from The Wheel of Time being a tree singer. And some wood is this thing that's such a beauty and so rare. And it's a dying art for Loial. I wonder, you know, we don't see the dwarves fading in the Third Age or going into the Fourth Age of Middle Earth. But when do they fade? Mm. Because clearly they fade in Tolkien's, you know, if I know that it's not fully our world after a certain point, he made the decision to sever it from a false origin story. But, you know, I think really it's the age of men after a certain point, right? That's the whole point.
Yeah. And I don't think he ever completely let go of the idea that it was our world, but in a different history. I mean, he says that quite clearly. Yes, towards the end, he was thinking about changing origin stories, but that was simply because he decided that if the elves are learning all of their science from the Valar, they're not going to come up with things like light from trees that eventually produce fruit that eventually become the sun and the moon. That was the kind of tension that he was dealing with. Nonetheless, certainly in his heart, I think, he wanted to be able to say, you could draw a through line from the Shire in the Third Age to Warwickshire around the time of the Jubilee of Queen Victoria. And that was very dear to his heart, that idea.
Right.
I'm not sure that the dwarves faded. I think they just retreated and disappeared.
So you think there's still dwarves around that we can, you know, knock a couple holes into the mountains and find them?
Who knows? Who has explored every single mountain range throughout?
It's true. You know,
all around the world here.
It's true.
And I think you could make an even stronger case that there's still elves around. Because the elves exist as long as this earth exists.
Right. And you have the Avari, right?
You have the Avari. And I don't think they exist in a physical form anymore. I think they're Fae have, you know, basically used up their Froa, and now they exist. And it's interesting, Fae and Fae. Fae is a word for the Fae.
Mm-hmm.
Also means the fair folk.
Nice.
So, you know, they could be standing in that bush that suddenly catches your attention and you don't really know why.
Right. That's anyway, a lovely sentiment.
It's fun to think so. And the thing about the one thing I can say about the singing to the mountain, when we see them pleading with the mountain to return the bodies of the four miners with the breath still in them, you have a supportive chorus. There's this choral, again, sort of a ground-based kind of a line that Disa sings over and extemporizes on and does riffs and so forth. So it is interesting. I'm not sure how much the dwarves value individuals unless they have a specific gift that their culture recognizes.
Right, or they're a king by right, right? You know,
right, exactly.
The line of Doran.
But she needs the supportive singing of her fellows. And still this wonderful low rumbly bass sound and voice and so on. So that there's a, right. you know, same culture, very similar kinds of
right.
music. No.
Well, we've got a few more people to talk about. Mm-hmm.
Yep, we got the Southlanders, who really don't have musical statements very often. And they're very short. It's one melody. It's never really developed very much. And again, mm-hmm. we get Illan pipes, which I find interesting. What were they trying to indicate with that?
Yeah,
because I don't think they're Irish. I don't think they're Harfoots.
No, but they are. Are they displaced? I guess they're not. They were there before, but they are.
Yes, they were.
They're almost morally displaced, right? They were. They fought for Morgoth, and now they are here trying to, you know, redeem themselves, a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. It could be a reflection of their interaction with the elves that had been, quote unquote, protecting them for hundreds of years.
Because what could go wrong with a military occupation?
Oh, gee, who knows? Who can say, right? And it's also used as Halbrand's theme throughout this first episode, which is very interesting because it turns out that Halbrand's theme is Sauron's theme backwards.
Right. It's a palindrome, which mm-hmm. is, it's the same front or back. Or rather, it can go front or back.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's super fun. Bear McCreary snuck that through to us. He loved talking about it on the podcast. He lit yes. up when we asked about it.
Yes, yes. He gave us a clue.
Yep.
To the probably the biggest question of the entire series. Where in the world is Sauron?
Yeah.
So I'll be interested to see. I'll be interested to see if we do get more development of the Southlanders music. Or, I mean, are they all wiped out now, basically? At least between Orodruin and Os Tirith.
I guess the region is wiped out for sure. There are some survivors with the people, but are they still Southlanders or are they something else?
Well, I suspect that Southlanders was a name that was given to them.
Right.
They may have their own
right
that nobody maybe ever bothered to use.
Yeah, maybe they'll be the population that, you know, because a decent amount of Numenoreans come over, but not enough for a kingdom. So maybe they'll be the founding members of Gondor.
Could be. I mean, they've already talked about the fact that there was a settlement
along the coasts
of the Anduin. And mm-hmm. Branwen and Arondir and Theo are planning to head in that direction, or at least at the end of season one, they were.
Yeah, so maybe it would make sense for them to become sort of incorporated into Numenorean society.
Mm-hmm. Some of them. I'm also thinking of at the end of the War of the Ring, and when Sauron is destroyed, there's a line that says that Aragorn gave the lands of Mordor to the slaves of Sauron.
Hmm.
And my first thought when I heard that was, oh, wow, he's even, you know, giving the orcs a place to live, giving the orcs a homeland, as Adar was so keen to do. But when I expressed this on one of the Discord channels, everybody was saying, no, that meant human slaves. That didn't mean orc slaves. You know, all the orcs have to be wiped out, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe some of the Southlanders now are going to be those slaves of Sauron, you know, several thousand years from now.
Yeah, could be.
And they will eventually get the land back.
Right.
I'm not sure how good that... Well, farther south than Orodruin, way far south, around the inland sea of Nurnin, there are green pastures and lands that can grow food and stuff, because otherwise nobody could survive in Mordor.
Right. Right. Well, I hope they're able to make Mordor great again, as they say.
Well, maybe give it a different name.
That would be a good idea.
That's a good start.
Well, I switched the order of my notes here. Because
you did indeed.
I thought that Sauron would be an appropriate next step after this discussion.
Definitely.
So incredibly dramatic and chromatic melody here, where it's just you get to that. Oh, it's so dirty, that minor second. It feels wrong, right? The whole thing feels unnatural and slimy, and it feels like there's evil circling you, and that you can't get away from it. And then just when you start to feel a little comfortable with the melody, Bear changes the key by a half step, and now you feel like it's upping the stakes, and he's going to get you. It reminded me very much of like the Hans Zimmer style, right? This Batman style where he's like, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. It's very similar. It's become pretty popular over the last like 20 years.
Which you're going to laugh now, but what you just hummed took me straight back to my favorite Batman of all time, which is da 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 Batman. It's the same thing, you know, the half step down and up. Isn't that funny? I wonder if that was intentional. For me, it feels like it's drilling inside me, like a tapeworm, you know, eating me out from the inside or something that. But I can also see circling around you on the outside.
Yeah. It reminds me of basically that scene where Halbrand reveals himself to Galadriel, and she's sort of stuck in this vision, and she can't get out of it. That's what this theme feels like to me, and I thought Bear nailed this one.
Interesting. Yeah, that reveal when he says, you know, I have existed before the sun rose. I have had many names. I mean, the actor, Charlie Vickers, just nailed it.
Yeah.
You could see the transformation. He finally, once and for all, you know, shook off Halbrand and all of his doings. And
I really loved his portrayal. And at the same time, I hope we never see it again. I hope that Sauron becomes Annatar. And I hope that there is a different form.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Takes on that role.
That'd be nice. I want to see that he was there in some form before we met Halbrand. And he poisoned the Elves tree and seeded the story of the origins of Mithril.
I don't want to talk about Mithril now.
Yeah, I don't really either. But anyway, they've got a lot of directions they can go, don't they?
Yeah, I think that they're going with the Mithril thing as a fact in this story. But
oh, John, say it isn't so.
We'll see. I would put money on it that this is a fact.
Well, I'm afraid you're probably right, but I still am going to cling to hope.
That's fair.
Until all hope is gone.
Hope is never meager.
Even when it is mere. No, hope is never mere, even when it is meager. There we go. Yeah, I also hope they clean up Gil-galad a little bit, too. Again,
yeah, he was a little deceptive, a little sneaky over there.
He was just so incredibly political, though.
Yeah.
I cannot picture the minstrels sadly singing about him. So I think he's going to have some arc. I hope he's going to have some arc.
Yeah.
Throughout the series. I mean, I can't picture this one sacrificing his life and killing Sauron, even knowing that he's going to be killed and in a fairly gruesome way.
He reminds me more of Thingol and his personality in the Silmarillion.
Yes. Interesting.
Maybe that's what they're going for. Maybe they want us to see a Thingol not have a fall from grace.
Huh. I was just about to complain about how many times people try to throw Thingol into this, that, and the other character. Now I'm thinking of Thranduil from the movies that shall not be mentioned.
Oh, no. We're not doing Thranduil, but Thingol. Yeah. I mean, I love the story surrounding Thingol because I think he's such a fascinating character, but certainly not the kindest elf that you've ever met.
No, he had him a fair amount of pride, but you know, you marry a Maiar, I guess.
Yep.
It kind of goes to your head after a while. And then you stop listening to her.
Well, speaking of Maiar, I guess we should probably talk about the Istar.
Yeah.
The stranger.
Beautiful transition there, sir. My hat is off to you.
Oh, thank you. I do this for a living, you know.
do you? I know you do it.
I do it for a supplement to living.
There we go.
So The Stranger honestly was a very controversial figure in the show, but
definitely
I really liked it. I really liked the whole thing. I honestly hope it's Gandalf. It feels very fitting that he met the hobbits before they were hobbits and helps them settle down. The Wanderer helps them settle down.
So you're letting go of the Blue Wizard, huh?
Oh, I'm almost certainly convinced it's not a Blue Wizard. Well, I would love for it to be.
I'm one of those who's going to hold out hope for a while yet.
Fair enough. I just don't know how many rights they have to it, you know?
Well, this is true. I mean, it could be one that they're going to ask for, you know? But given how they did Sauron, I think probably this is going to be Gandalf.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of sad, but, you know, set it aside, go for the ride, see what they give us.
Yeah. Well, The Stranger comes in with this theme that is just, they just filled a room full of echoey objects and made a reverb chamber for this because it is so distant. And these plucked strings that feel like they're just in the background. And it almost feels like the stars in the sky, right? These little picking out little stars in the sky. Mm-hmm. But what's coolest to me about this melody is that it's constantly changing the center of the key. It feels like there is no home to the song. And this gray wanderer has no home.
Yeah, yeah, that's nice. They do finally give us resolution when he achieves resolution.
Right.
And says, I am good. And defeats the Hissy sisters and, accepts his power finally.
Yeah. Not my favorite piece of dialogue, I am good. But
yeah, I know, but I stood up and cheered because what else can you say at that point? His mind is still clouded as the sisters tell him.
I get it.
So I also, what you're talking about here with all of the sounds and everything, it's called a gamelan, which is, it's not an instrument. It's more of an orchestra of a variety of different instruments. And it was used, actually, for Smaug in the Hobbit film. So that if that sound and the tonality and the texture of it sounded familiar to listeners and they had not heard a gamelan before, to their knowledge.
Oh, very cool. I'm looking at it now. I've never heard of this before.
Yeah, it's a wonderful ensemble, assembly, if you will. I can't call it an instrument, although it is referred to in the collective as a gamelan.
Yeah.
So tell us some of the things you're seeing there.
I'm just seeing this Japanese, Balinese, Sudanese. Just a lot of metal instruments.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of things going on. It's very busy.
Very percussive. I think most of what you're seeing there is going to be struck with some kind of a striker or a hammer or stick or something.
Yeah. Wow. Beautiful.
Percussive and yet also chordal and melodic.
Right.
You don't often get that particular combination, which is probably why it sounds like stars, as you said. I like that a lot.
Yeah, it sounds otherworldly, right?
Exactly.
It should for an Istar.
For a stranger, indeed. Well, anything else that you want to bring to us tonight, John?
They should have let Bear McCreary make the theme. That's all I'm going to say. He should have made the title theme.
I know
we love Howard Shore. I think they should have given it to Bear.
Well, I think he was doing homage, and I respect that. And I adore that theme. I'll often sing it to myself in my head. That one and the theme of the elves returning to Valinor, I will play those tracks in my head when I'm trying to fall asleep at night and it's not happening right away.
Well, that's lovely. I put the Silmarillion on when I'm ready to go to sleep, but generally of Valerian and its realms. I'm out in three sentences for of Valerian and its realms.
No, any textual anything my brain is just going to seep onto it, particularly
that's,
if it's already.
That's funny. I'm the opposite. Kind of active music anyway. Will keep me up.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Marilyn, it's always lovely to speak with you about Tolkien or anything, really, but thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, John, the pleasure is all mine, and I hope our listeners as well, because it's so good to have that perspective. Well, just to hear different voices, too, but given your knowledge and your background, both music and of Tolkien, you were definitely a prize. So thank you very much for stepping forward and saying, I'd like to do this. And I said, yeah, let's do it.
I'm really happy that we got to do this. It was a great conversation. And it went about twice as long as I expected it to, which
oh, come
is
on,
par
John.
For the course.
Haven't I was to say, haven't you learned by now?
I was looking at your outline earlier. I was like, this will be a half hour easy.
sure. But we digress, yes. Okay, well, thank you. And listeners, I hope you've enjoyed this special interview. And write in and tell us, what do you think? Tell us your own discoveries that you've made about the music and how it reflects the cultures and the peoples in the Rings of Power. So that's it for this bonus episode. Write in and let us know what you think and anything else you'd like to share with us. We are planning on doing a final feedback episode. You may email us at ringsandrituals@thelorehounds.com or post on the Lorehounds Discord server, where we have a special channel set up just for Rings and Rituals. On the Lorehounds website, there is also a contact form and a voicemail feature. Look for the Contact Us link at the bottom of the page. Also, be sure to check out the other podcasts supported by the Barovian Broadcasting Network. We have Radioactive Ramblings with Aaron and Chase, who I think have finished doing Fallout and are now doing Invincible. We have the Properly Howard Movie Review with Steve and Anthony, currently reviewing Felonies and Fugazis. And if you want to know what a Fugazi is, well, then you better listen. Wool Shift Dust with Alicia, and her latest podcast, The Star Wars Canon Timeline. And of course, John and David on the main Lorehounds podcast, currently reviewing Season 1 of Hot D in advance of Season 2 in June, among other goodness. Links for all of these are also in the show notes, and you can look for the link tree. Our thanks to our recording engineer for the episode, John, to David, Alicia, and John, our producers, and to John for arranging our theme music, as well as all the others who support us along the way. If you would like to support us and the podcast, rate and review us on your podcatcher of choice, or find us on Patreon at patreon.com/thelorehounds, or on Supercast. Subscribers will get access to ad-free versions of all the podcasts, as well as many other benefits. Until next time, then, remember, it is said by the Eldar, that in water there lives yet the echo of the music of the Ainur more than in any substance else that is in this earth. And many of the children of Ilúvatar hearken still unsated to the voices of the sea, and yet know not for what they listen. Nakamin, farewell.
Nicole, did you ever notice how The Sign by Ace of Base has really strange key changes?
I did not, Mark. I'm a real person.
Well, let me tell you about it. I'll let you talk about neuroscience gobbledygook.
Yes, I thought you'd never ask.
This is the Nevermind the Music podcast,
where one psychologist
and one musician
deep dive into the songs you love,
so you don't have to.
And there's plenty of time to get off topic.
From Semi-Charmed Life to The Way You Move.
And who could forget The Crossroads?
Is it The Crossroads or The Crossroads?
Save it for the episode, Mark.
Listen to Nevermind the Music
wherever you get your podcasts.